Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Open Forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Thank you for being with us. Open Forum is your opportunity to call with any question you might have about Catholic faith or practice or really any religious question you might have at all. If you have a question, please do not hesitate to ask. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. I am Cy Kellett, your host. In addition to being open to any question, we're also open to any caller, whether you are Catholic or non-Catholic or none of the above. 888-318-7884. Our guest this hour, Carl Keating, founder and senior fellow at Catholic Answers. He's the author of 7 books, including his most recent two, The New Geocentrists and The Ultimate Catholic Quiz. His books, Catholicism and Fundamentalism and What Catholics Really Believe, have been national bestsellers. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Sal. It's good to be with you.
Thank you very much. It's very, very good to be with you. You know, I was wondering when I knew you were coming in today, you've been doing apologetics for a long time.
That's right. I think Coolidge was president when I started.
Really? Yeah. Silent Cal was in the White House. But I always wonder when someone's been at something like this, especially an apostolate where, you know, Christ is present in the work when one hopes, are you different at it now? Or do you know how you're different at it now than you were, say, when you started?
Yeah. I'm more conscious that I'm worse.
Really?
there's the sense of that. Because when you start out something with a lot of enthusiasm, you think you've got a handle on it largely. Like life.
Right.
Okay. You're married?
Yes, okay. I am.
You knew a lot more about marriage before you got married than once you got married. And once you got married, you found out largely from your wife. You didn't know much.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Parenting the same way. Yeah. I was an expert before I had children.
Right. So it's something like that with apologetics even.
Yeah.
Because you realize over time there are a lot of subtleties you didn't appreciate earlier on.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing, of course, to be able to answer a question, you know, when did such and so happen, or you know, what does this paragraph in the catechism mean, or this Bible verse, or what have you. But I think what one comes to appreciate, at least should appreciate over time, is that often the question that is asked is not really the problem that the person has.
Oh, you know? I see.
And that's something that you come to see sort of after the fact. I've answered that person's question correctly on the surface.
Yeah.
But in a way, I didn't deal with his problem.
Okay? Uh-huh.
All right. For example, I'll give you an ancient example. There were two heresies of Arianism and Monophysitism. And the one said that Christ had only a human nature.
Right.
And the other said that Christ had only a divine nature. And they were not enemies so much as competitors. They existed at the same time, these two heresies. But actually, they came from the same principle, which is that Christ could have only one nature. So which nature was it?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
So you can deal with that particular historical/doctrinal conundrum, saying, yeah, he's got two natures, and here's why. And so the Arians were wrong, and the Monophysites were wrong. But you can miss, as I discovered many apologists did, the fact that they come from the same wrong principle.
Yes.
And what you really would like to do as an apologist is to get to a person's principle, the wrong ones, and figure out what those are.
Right.
Because normally a person who has a problem with the Catholic faith doesn't have just one problem. Okay. I've never met somebody whose only problem with the Catholic faith is that he doesn't believe in indulgences or doesn't believe that Mary was always a virgin, but everything else he accepts.
Yeah. Other than that, I'd be
No, it's never the case.
Yeah.
And so what is the root problem a person has? Well, that's the kind of thing that you just don't think about much when you first get into the work.
I see.
Okay? Because you're looking at what's the answer to A, B, C. Okay.
Right.
And so over time, you come to see it could be difficult to figure out what is really the root problem for a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that inculcates a bit of humility. It does inculcate, if nothing else, a sense of inadequacy, because you're not always able to figure that out. You can answer the surface thing and yet not be doing what you really like to do for that person because you've not really answered the underlying problem, whatever that might be.
Right. So you can, in a way, you could answer a question but not answer the person. That the person may have a much bigger need than that.
Yeah. You know, there are a lot of people, for example, Trent will acknowledge this because he deals with atheists quite a lot. Atheists come with a particular set of stock arguments against the existence of God.
Right.
And they're pretty puerile. They're pretty low level, actually, even for very intelligent people who are atheists. But you need to get behind that to see what the problem. Why are these atheists, if they don't believe in God, so upset about him and so angry at him? Okay. You know, who's angry at Zeus? Nobody, yeah. Right?
Okay. I haven't met anybody yet.
Yeah,
no.
That's right. So what is the issue here? And, you know, it often is a moral issue, okay, because our will and our intellect need to grow together like rungs on a ladder. And if one is off kilter, the other tends to get off kilter. So if we have a problem morally, we'll end up with a problem intellectually and the other way around. So very often the atheist's root problem is a moral one, not an intellectual one, not a philosophical one. And yet it's not always easy to figure that out. And so you can, as Trent will acknowledge, you can often find yourself or, say, a newer apologist struggling or dealing with the surface questions that the atheist might pose, rat-a-tat-tat, one after the next.
Right.
And yet not really getting to that person's problem, you know.
And does that mean when you deal with that person, then it may seem like obstinacy.
Yes.
That I don't want to, like, in the face of overwhelming intellectual evidence, I still won't believe. But it's not necessarily obstinacy. It's that their problem is in a different realm. It needs to be addressed.
It's usually both. Yeah. It's usually both. years ago, I used to write regularly for a local alternative newspaper, which is run by a very fine Catholic man. And he would send me out to the city to write feature stories that would make public speakers look foolish. And all I had to do was report what they said. And the main place that I found such juicy subject matter was the local Unitarian Church, which had a series of lectures. And I would go there, and most of the people who were given lectures were not believers in anything. And they were just off the wall in their comments, in their ideas. And all I had to do is put those into print. There was no editorializing involved or allowed. I would simply quote the people. And when you actually sat down and read it, I said, this is nuts. You know, what is the problem with this person? You know?
Yeah, right.
But of course it goes back, as I say, you know, to usually a combination of intellectual and moral conundrums within the individual. And it's not always easy to sort those out for the benefit of that person.
Yeah. Now, when you're saying the atheist, for example, may have a moral problem, do you mean that they have a moral problem in that there's a moral failing in the church that they're having trouble with?
No, or a moral failing in themselves.
I see, yeah.
That is masked by the atheism.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
One way to get around not following God's law is to say that there is no such law because there's no God.
Yeah.
And if there's no God, then anything's permissible in theory. Okay.
Yeah.
Just what can you get away with? Okay. And so if one way to get past that is simply to deny that there's any such moral exigency out there.
Right.
And a lot of atheists do that. Now, there are others who don't and whose lives, so far as we can tell, are perfectly upright. And they have more of a purely intellectual problem.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
But when I used to do these articles and I would go out to these places and find these lectures to listen to, more often than not, it was the former kind. It was pretty obvious from the way a person was talking about whatever the issue might have been that it wasn't purely intellectual. It wasn't his reasoning that brought him to conclude that God doesn't exist, because actually reason rightly used can't lead you there. It actually leads you –
right.
You know, the ancient Greeks, you know, Aristotle, Plato, and so on, proved through reason alone that God exists.
Right.
And they proved most of his attributes, you know, his omniscience, his omnipresence, his – omnipotence, you know, all these things. You can prove that through pure reason. What they couldn't prove, of course, is his personhood, his triple personhood. That had to wait for revelation.
Yeah.
But through reason alone, properly used, you can prove a lot about God. And the one thing you certainly can prove is that he exists. And then, you realize, as the Greeks realized, if God created me, I have to be obedient to him. And then you figure out what that means. But at least they got that far. But if you misuse your reason, then you think you've proven that he doesn't exist. But that's not a proper use of reason.
Yeah.
It's not flipping a coin and could go this way or that way. That's not a reason in any area. I mean, it's easiest to see in something like math or in physics or something. If it's properly used, it only can go this way. That's also true in metaphysics as well as physics. Okay.
Yeah.
And it can only go this way if properly used. But it's so easy to fool ourselves that we've used it properly and we, in fact, have abused it or misused it, and we've come to a wrong conclusion that we then stick with because for whatever reason we find it comfortable to have this illusion. And one advantage Catholics have over such folks is that if they accept the faith fully and then they truly know what things are, they don't have to worry about being disillusioned ever because they're not illusioned in the first place. Mm-hmm. See?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's a great advantage.
Amen. Carl Keating, our guest this hour. Carl Keating, the founder of Catholic Answers, our guest this hour on Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum, so we'll take any question on any aspect of Catholic life or faith. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back with your calls.
Carl wants to hear from you today on Catholic Answers Live.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Did you know you can book any of our great speakers to speak at your parish or special event? Contact one of our seminar coordinators through the Speakers Bureau section on Catholic.com today to find out more information.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Mark 8:14, Jesus had just taken a deep sigh over the hardness of the Pharisees' hearts when he encounters the disciples' lack of understanding. They had forgotten to bring enough bread on the boat, so when Jesus then said to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, they immediately thought he was referring to their lack of sufficient bread. They hadn't picked up on the dishonesty of the Pharisees, even after all they had witnessed. Jesus was clearly annoyed at them. By now they should have had a clue. It is a tribute to St. Mark that he showed the apostles in an unflattering light. He didn't touch up his account to make them seem better than they were. They were as human as you and I are. The Lord comes to us all just as we are in our humanity. Our greatest asset is not that we're perfect, but that we are loved by him. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Carl Keating is our guest this hour on Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live. Any questions you've got on faith, religion, morals, Catholic teaching, we're happy to take. I am your host, Cy Kellett. Our number, 888-318-7884. And we go to Daniela, listening in Pueblo, Mexico. Daniela, you are on with Carl Keating.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Okay, so here's my question. You know how we had the Catholic and Orthodox churches, and then after Florence, the Council of Florence, some of them came back, and now they're known as Eastern Catholics. Well, my problem is, my question is, a friend of mine told me that he's Eastern Catholic, and he says that sometimes they actually venerate saints that are not considered saints by the Catholic Church proper, but they're, like, tolerated, people like Gregory Palamas, who I hear that some of them actually venerate him, and we Catholics would never, ever, ever consider venerating him since He called the Pope and Catholics heretics, and he opposed reunion of the churches. So I was wondering whether this is true, and like to what degree can Eastern Catholics venerate saints that are not officially saints by the Catholic Church's opinion? And secondly would be, why does the Church allow them to venerate them?
Well, Daniela, let's divide this up a little bit. First of all, any person in heaven is a saint, whether formally canonized or not. So if we have good reason to think that there may be somebody, maybe even a relative of ours, who's in heaven, it would be proper to venerate that person privately. Okay, we wouldn't do that at Mass in the parish church, and it wouldn't be a feast of the church and so on. But certainly any saint in heaven could be venerated. So to the extent that Gregory or others from the who are venerated as saints in the Eastern Orthodox Church, to the extent that, in fact, they are in heaven, of course, it'd be proper to venerate them. Now, it's true that some, like Gregory, during their lifetimes were rather anti-Roman in certain respects. This doesn't necessarily mean that they ended up leading lives that were disreputable or unholy, because people who are in error can also be very holy people and can be saintly. So it's not necessarily wrong, then, to venerate such people, presuming, of course, that they are, in fact, in heaven. We acknowledge that we have some saints in common with, the Eastern churches, Eastern Orthodox churches, and there are some that they've identified. For example, the Tsar Nicholas II and his family are recognized or considered to be saints by the Russian Orthodox Church. The Catholic Church doesn't recognize them as such, but we might perceive them to be martyrs for Christianity, since they were killed by the Bolsheviks in 1918. Would it be proper to, pray to them on the assumption that they're in heaven? That would be okay, just as we could pray to anybody, for example, maybe our grandparents, whom we think might be in heaven by this time. That would be fine. But again, that would not be, in the Catholic context, a part of formal liturgical practice. That would be something private. Okay. So to that extent, we can accept a kind of veneration of those individuals whom the Eastern churches believe are saints, but the Western Church has not determined them to be so. So we have that kind of position. The key thing to keep in mind is that the Church, in its liturgical calendar, assigns for the veneration of Catholics in general only those for whom it's quite sure these people are in heaven. So we have the canonized saints, and they'll have feast days, and you can look them up as to what dates those might be. And those would be, in most cases, universal feasts, where any Catholic in the world at Mass can be celebrating those particular saints. There are others, this is more true of the beatified, who can be recognized locally. So, for example, here in San Diego, we now have Junipero Serra as a saint, and so he's a saint of the whole church. Any diocese of Arlington, Virginia can be having a Mass in his honor. But when he was just a blessed until a few years ago, we in San Diego, where he did his work, would be able to have a Mass in his honor, but the Virginia diocese would not. Okay. Oh, see, yeah. There's a distinction there. So when a person is elevated to full sainthood, then it's a kind of universal approbation. Okay. Someone who's beatified is in heaven, but the cultus, that is the religious following of the person in a liturgical sense, is normally geographically limited up until that point. Okay. So there's a distinction there. So I hope that helps a little bit, Daniela.
Thank you, Daniela. We go to Brandon in Houston, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Brandon, you are on Open Forum with Carl Keating.
Thank you. Thank you. Good evening. My question is, why do some words in the prayers or in Mass change over time?
What do you mean? Can you give an example, Brandon?
So like in the Hail Mary, when like Hail Mary full of grace, blessed art thou. Why does it change to like you over time?
Oh, from thou to you?
Yeah, so like why do some words in prayers or like even in the Mass Why does it change over time?
Well, the thou and you is actually coming from an old translation of the original Latin there that was used in the liturgy, where in Latin and other Romance languages, there's a distinction between the pronouns used for a single individual and the plural pronoun. We've lost that in English. So we used to be able to, say thou, meaning you, singular, and you, which meant only plural. Okay. But over the centuries, that was lost in English, and we haven't used that commonly for centuries now. So we use you for both singular and plural. Except we still see that in some older prayers. And we see it in particular with respect to prayers addressed directly to God. We'll see that he is referenced as thou, not as you. Okay, and often in print it's capitalized rather than lowercase. But that's simply a reflection of the change of the English language over time. There are some languages that don't have that kind of distinction between the singular you and the plural you. Okay, Japanese is another one, for example, okay, which I'm somewhat familiar with. They don't have that. So that's where that comes in. And so if you would find a translation of, let's say, just the text of the Mass, if you see an older missal, and on the left page, normally you would, at that time you would have seen Latin, and on the right you would see English. As late as the 1960s, you'd be seeing a rather modern English, commonly the Confraternity of Christian Doctrine translation from the 1940s. That was stately but modern English. There were no these and thous in it. But prior to that, before that translation was used, there were these and thous in the translation, because the translation that was used then was actually mostly coming out of the 17th and 18th century, where they were still using the these and thous in prayer. Okay, even by that time, aside from, say, the Quakers, in regular English, the thee and thou usage was falling away. So even today in America, Quakers refer to one another as thee and thou. Okay, but that's really an anachronism. That's really not otherwise used. Brandon, does that help?
Yes, yes, sir. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Brandon. You know, I wonder about if there's, but there's a different thing when we say, the one that comes to mind, what came to mind when Brandon said that, one in being now is consubstantial.
Okay, but in that sense, yeah. This is a more, the newer translation we have of the vernacular Mass of the ordinary form in English, the newer translation that came out a few years ago, aimed for more precision in the translation, less looseness. Okay, it tried to be more precise compared to the Latin original text, the main text, the official yes. text is Latin. So the first translation we had of the Pauline Missal that came out from the end of the 1960s was not as precise as it could have been in quite a few areas. And so this redo of it was an attempt, largely successful, I think, to make the English correspond more accurately to the Latin. It was an attempt to be old-fashioned sounding. But some of the words will sound old-fashioned to people simply because they hadn't been using them for a while.
Right.
But there's really nothing old-fashioned or newfangled about a word such as consubstantial. It's a word that people don't use in everyday conversation. But then if you think about it, a lot of the words in the Creed and elsewhere in the Mass are not words we otherwise use except in the Mass.
Right.
Okay. So I think most people by this time have gotten used to these. And consubstantial is coming ultimately from a philosophical term. It's got words of roots of philosophy within it.
Right.
And, you know, con means with, substantial, substance, that is, or essence, what the thing really is. So it's has a stronger philosophical impact than simply saying one in being, okay,
right.
Which is a looser phrase. It means the same thing in a certain way, but one in being could also be understood in a looser way that some people could take it to imply the wrong thing.
Yeah, yeah. 888-318-7884 is the number here at Catholic Answers Live. Our topic, well, your choice today, because forum here on Catholic Answers Live. Our guest, Carl Keating. I am Cy Kellett, your host. We will be right back.
Live.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm here to tell you about my new book, Hard Sayings, A Catholic Approach to Answering Bible Difficulties. Have you ever read something in the Bible that confused you? Or has a skeptic ever asked you to explain a scandalous passage and you didn't know what to say? Doesn't Genesis contradict science? Why does the Bible promote slavery? How could God order his people to kill women and children? It's happened to just about everyone. But now you have a place to turn for the answers. In Hard Sayings, I look at dozens of the most confounding passages in Scripture and offer clear, reasonable, and Catholic keys to unlocking their true meaning. After reading this book, you'll be equipped to answer the toughest questions skeptics ask about the Bible. So don't be left without an answer again. Order your copy of Hard Sayings today by calling 1-888-291-8000, by visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
It's been called a crash course in salvation history, the perfect addition to CCD and RCIA reading lists. Catholic Answers' new graphic novel, The Big Picture, has set the Catholic book world on fire with its unique and innovative blend of apologetics and entertainment. With high-quality, full-color illustrations and a storyline that's easy to follow, The Big Picture reveals a story full of passion, suspense, adventure, and hope, engaging the reader immediately. As our heroes come face to face with the drama and mystery of God's plan for the salvation of the world, it gets readers talking and thinking, captivating and entertaining them with eternal truths presented in a non-threatening way. Get your friends and family talking about things that matter. Order your copy of The Big Picture today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Today is Open Forum, and our guest this hour is the founder of Catholic Answers, Carl Keating. If you have questions about the Bible, sacraments, doctrines, popes, the history of the Catholic Church, you name it, this is your chance. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. But before we go back to calls, I want to invite you to sail with Catholic Answers June 3rd through 10th of this year aboard Holland America's MS. Carl, help me with it.
Veendam.
Oh. Right. You're the only person who's been authoritative. Is that right? The right word? Authoritative on that. Everyone else weasels around. I don't know.
That's because I'm willing to tell you how it's pronounced, even if I'm not sure. But you
that's
think
good thing
I know.
Okay. If you don't know, you're willing to make it up. All right. So the MS Veendam, we just sail out of Montreal, cruise through Canada and New England, enjoy ports of call such as Montreal, Quebec City, Charlottetown on Prince Edward Island.
Very important for Anne of Green Gables. For those who are interested.
Is that where she's from?
That's right.
Charlottetown?
Yeah.
All right.
Prince Edward, yep.
All right. Well, that's kind of a pilgrimage right there in itself. Sydney, Halifax, Bahaba, and Boston. The speakers on the cruise, Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers, Tim Staples, director of apologetics, Patrick Madrid, who's from everywhere. I mean, but mostly,
currently from Ohio, but
yeah,
yes.
But mostly from the Patrick Madrid show on Immaculate Heart Radio, Father Paul Check. From the Diocese of Bridgeport, Connecticut. I guess they're pulling up to his house to drop him off at the end of this, practically. And there's also a three-day pre-cruise event in Montreal if you would like to participate in that. We have a New Year's special this month. Book now and get $100 off per person by entering the promotion code NY2017 on your online application. For more information, call the Cruise Authority at 800-707-1634 or visit CatholicAnswersCruise.com.
You know, we had the similar cruise some years ago, and I was on that one. I won't be on this one. This is a beautiful cruise. Of the four cruises from North America that are possible, the Caribbean, Mexican Riviera, Alaska, and the St. Lawrence Seaway out to the Atlantic Ocean, there's a good argument that this might be the most interesting. It's certainly, in a way, the most Catholic. You might think the Caribbean would be. But I remember going down the St. Lawrence, and there's this gigantic statue of Our Lady up on one of the wooded cliffs there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very impressive. And, you know, the captain gets on the intercom and explains all this to the 2,000 people on the ship, whatever it was, most of whom aren't Catholic. But it was a kind of prophetic experience in a way. But this is very interesting. So whether you're, you know, as I said, as my wife would be, you know, interested in Anne of Green Gables and want to see that, Or you'd love to stop in someplace like Halifax, where I can recommend to you the best tea shop in North America. Which
really, a special tip. If you book right. now, Carl Keating will tell you about the best tea shop in North America.
But this is a beautiful cruise. So I do recommend that if you've not had a chance to be up that way, and most Americans from the southern or western parts have never been to that part of Canada or the U.S., consider this. This is a lovely place to go. Perfect time of year for it. Mild weather.
Yeah, really.
You have some good speakers, even though Pat will be along. But you have some good speakers.
What?
Yeah.
You pick on Patrick Madrid that way?
Always.
I can't believe that. I practically venerate the man. No, not true. But all right. So despite Patrick Madrid being on the cruise, you're saying it will still be an excellent cruise.
It will still be, yeah. Actually, it'll be all the better with having Pat along, you know.
Deborah from Toledo, Ohio, you are on. Deborah's listening on 89.7 FM. Deborah, you're on with Carl Keating. What's your question?
Hello, Deborah.
No, Deborah?
Hello.
Hello. Hi, Deborah.
Oh, there you are. Okay. What's your question, Deborah?
Hi, how are you? I have a question in regards to baptism.
Okay.
Is there a particular religion in need if you want to get baptized and you don't belong to any particular denomination?
I'm not quite sure what you're asking. Would you have somebody, is this yourself or somebody else, who's doesn't belong to any particular church but wants to be baptized?
I have a friend of mine. She belongs to Jehovah's Witness.
Okay.
And she literally is on her deathbed.
Okay. Mm.
And she wants to be baptized. And I believe within that religion, they don't allow her to because of certain morals, but she wants to be baptized. So is there any other way going around the Jehovah Witnesses' beliefs where she can get baptized? I'm afraid that she's going to pass before she's able to be baptized.
The Jehovah's Witnesses are not Trinitarian. They don't believe in the Trinity.
Right.
You know, they believe in only what they call Jehovah God. And to be baptized, of course, is to be baptized into the name of the Trinity. You know, the priest, when he does the baptism, pours water on you, says, I baptize you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. So the Trinity. It's laudatory that she would like to be baptized. Obviously, this is to some degree in conflict with the church that she's been a member of. I certainly can understand why, you know, the minister from the local Jehovah's Witness Kingdom Hall is not going to come over and baptize her, because those folks don't believe in this. So she certainly could be baptized. Now, the question is, who can do the baptism? The Catholic Church teaches that actually any person can perform a baptism. You don't have to be a Catholic to perform a baptism. A Muslim can perform a baptism validly. A Jew can perform a baptism. An atheist could perform a baptism. All the person needs to do is to follow the form. That is, to pour the water or to dunk the person in the water, to sprinkle water on the person, and simultaneously say the words that I just said. And all that person needs to have in his mind is a will to do whatever the Catholic Church does, even if the person doesn't understand it and even if the person doesn't agree with it. But so long as the person doing the baptism says, in essence, in his mind, I'm doing whatever the Catholic Church thinks it's doing with baptism, and here then performs the rite, that baptism is valid. Okay. So, and the reason Christ set it up this way is that he wants people to be baptized, because without baptism, you know, we're not open to sanctifying grace, that we need baptism to get there. So, it's possible then that anybody could perform the baptism on your friend. It could be the local priest, if she's willing to have him. But if for some reason the priest isn't willing, it could be a Protestant minister, it could be you. Honestly, anybody could perform the baptism. And it would be certainly a great spiritual benefit to your friend. So I would look into doing that as rapidly as possible. I would go to a priest first to see if he'd be in a position to do so, because, of course, he'd be able to have certain other ministrations toward her that nobody else could. But if for some reason this is an emergency situation, priests aren't available, even you or someone else could perform the baptism.
Thank you, Deborah. Now, Carl, we're currently streaming live on Facebook Live, YouTube Live, and Periscope, another service that does that. And so people who are watching sometimes type in a question to us. I want to share a question with you from Courtney, who's watching on Facebook Live. I will be converting this year, and I am afraid to tell my mom. She is very anti-Catholic. Any advice?
Well, the first thing that occurs to me, Courtney, is to say congratulations because you have the courage of wanting to come into the church despite family opposition. That means there's a lot of grace working in you. So understand that, take advantage of it. Second, let's be very practical about this. You're not going to keep it hidden from your mother. So she's going to find out at some point, such as you come back one day from on Ash Wednesday and there's ashes on your forehead. She's going to say, what's that, right? Okay. So I say the sooner the better. You know, let her know. Sit her down. And you want to do this in a loving way and explain, you know, you don't say how old you are, but I presume you're maybe a young adult. You want to say, Mom, you know, I've thought through this. I've prayed through this. I've taken counsel with others. This is where I believe God is calling me. I know that you're not going to approve of this, but I know you love me and I love you. And I'm going to ask you, in essence, just to trust me on this, that this is what I believe is best for me. Okay. If you want, I can explain my reasons to you. I don't want to argue about it, though. You know, this is I've worked through this. This is where I believe God is calling me into the Catholic Church. And this is not the time to argue about it. If later on, down the road, you want to give me arguments about why I should leave the Catholic Church, I'm your daughter. I'll listen to you, you know, and we can talk about it. But at this point, I'd ask you not to try to dissuade me, but I do want to let you know this is what I'm doing. It's not to despite you or anybody else. It's what I think God is calling me to do. If you want to know my reasons here, and maybe you'll have some literature you could actually pass along to your mother to outline some points. It depends, of course, you know, what kind of opposition to the faith she has. Is she a Protestant fundamentalist? That's one kind of opposition. Is she an atheist? That's a different kind of opposition. Is she a liberal Protestant? Yeah, different kind of opposition. So you can find at Catholic.com and, you know, lots of materials that might be appropriate to deal with whatever particular things seem to annoy her about the Catholic faith. And so you might want to have those handy. But I think the way you start out is first not trying to hide it, being very upfront, letting her know that you love her and that you know that she loves you, but that this is something that since you love God more than you love yourself or her, that you have to do because God is calling you to this. And the very fact that you've written into the show and to indicate that you've got this issue with your mother is a sign of grace working in you already. And I think you want to capitalize on that and not let that die off. And as I say, give your mother the opportunity later on, once you're in the church, to initiate a discussion about why you shouldn't be a Catholic. And maybe by that time you'll have laid out, in a sense, your arguments, and you can understand hers. But it doesn't seem to me that this would be the opportune time to try to get into that tit-for-tat kind of thing. You're being called a certain way. Go ahead and follow that call. But don't hide it from your mom. And, you know, she'll get steamed. She might yell at you, whatever the case is going to be. She's already done that in your past life on other things, you know, if you're a normal person. So you've gotten past those things, you'll get past this. And, you know, we'll keep you in prayer and just, you know, keep us informed about the status and let us know how things go.
Thank you very much for the question, Courtney. Thanks for watching us on Facebook Live. Thanks to all of our viewers on Facebook Live, YouTube Live, and Periscope. This is Catholic Answers Live. Today is Open Forum. Our guest, Carl Keating, will be right back with more calls.
Hello, this is Archbishop Alexander Sample of the Archdiocese of Portland in Oregon. Keep that dial right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, my friends. This is Christopher Check, president of Catholic Answers, inviting you to join Tim Staples and me next summer, June 3rd to the 10th, as we sail from Montreal to Boston. Joining us also will be special guests, Patrick Madrid of Immaculate Heart Radio, and my brother, Father Paul Check. Catholic Answers has been the gold standard of Catholic cruising for over 15 years. This cruise will be the perfect blend of apologetics, church history, and spirituality as we talk about how to transform our land in Christ. We will explore some of North America's most magnificent churches, including the Shrine of St. Anne de Beaupré. We are also planning a special pre-cruise event in Montreal that will include a pilgrimage to the tomb of St. Kateri Tekakwitha, the Lily of the Mohawks. All of our cruises include daily mass, opportunities for confession, and the convivial company of fellow Catholics who share your love of the faith. Signups are brisk, so please don't delay registering. For all the details and to register, visit CatholicAnswersCruise.com. That's CatholicAnswersCruise.com.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm here to tell you about the most exciting and innovative Catholic book in years. In today's world, people from countless perspectives pose challenges to our Catholic faith every day, in conversations, through the mass media, on the internet, and more on the infinite collection of social media platforms. There's no getting away from this daily onslaught. We as Catholics need to stand strong, to be prepared, to mount a daily defense, to respond to the many challenges that we, as believers, are presented with every day. To that end, my good friend and apologist extraordinaire Jimmy Akin has come up with what will surely be a great resource for years to come, a daily defense. A daily defense takes up a different challenge for every day of the year, 366 in all, teaching you how you can defend the faith and give answers to Catholics and skeptics alike. And it's user-friendly, with challenges and answers indexed alphabetically by scripture verses or by topic. So finding the answers can be quick and easy. Order your copy of A Daily Defense today by calling 1-888-291-8000, by visiting Catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Carl Keating is our guest this hour on Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live. Any questions you've got on faith, religion, morals, 888-318-7884. What's up,
Carl? During the break, I looked at my phone, and it's blinking. And so I go to it. There's a message there, and the message is from Patrick Madrid, and it says, "I heard that."
You're in trouble with Patrick Madrid.
So for those of you who are coming to the show late at the previous session, we talked about our upcoming Catholic Answers Cruise, and Pat's going to be one of the guest speakers there. And I gave him a little poke in the ribs saying it'll be a good cruise despite the fact that Pat will be there. Actually, it'll be a great cruise because Pat will be there.
And you do not speak ill of Patrick Madrid. He's like, I think, I know that the president
No,
is probably,
I don't speak ill of Patrick Madrid because he knows Guido.
Oh, he does. Okay. Yeah. Well, I was going to say.
You don't fool with that.
I know the president is probably the number one Twitter user, but Patrick Madrid is probably number two. Like, he's got so many people. They'll tell him, Carl, if you say one bad word about Madrid.
But he was listening. So, you know.
Okay. Yeah.
So thanks, Pat.
Brandon, watching on YouTube Live, asks this, Carl, is the SSPX, the Society of St. Paul X, St. Pius X, coming back into full communion with Rome, likely to happen anytime soon?
Well, as I think you all know, this is the traditionalist order that has been on the outs with Rome since illicit consecrations in 1988. Just in the last number of days, there have been reports coming from Bishop Bernard Fillet, who's the head of the SSPX, indicating that the society may be close to getting a personal prelature, much like Opus Dei has, where there'd be a bishop or bishops for the society appointed or approved by Rome. And I presume this would mean at least the first one would be Fillet himself. And there'd be no geographic jurisdiction for the bishop. It's sort of a universal jurisdiction for the members of this group, just as with Opus Dei. Mm-hmm. Okay. Apparently that is coming fairly – coming to be more of a likelihood. It's a little unusual, a little maybe counterintuitive, because one might have thought more progress would have been made under Benedict the 16th than under Pope Francis. On the other hand, there have been some speculations as to why maybe things are starting to gel now than later. So there's no definitive word, but the most recent reports within the last week seem to be that this could be something that could come up. maybe, and even a date that was floated was May 13th, which is the Fatima anniversary date.
Yeah.
Not that the SSPX has any particular connection to Fatima, but just that it might be a convenient date to have such a regularization. So that's about all I know at the moment. But I would say it's maybe somewhat more likely appearing now than it was, say, a year ago.
And that is Opus Dei the only personal prelature?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this would be a second
personal
prelature. All right, we go to Donna in South Lake Tahoe, California, listening or watching on Periscope. Carl, this is the first Periscope viewer we've ever had calling the show. You don't look thrilled at all by that.
Well, I'm not surprised. How many people are on submarines?
Okay. Donna, calling from a submarine. You're on with Carl Keating. What's your question?
Hi, you guys. How you doing?
Good, thank you.
My question is, I've got a friend at work that came back to the Catholic Church 3 weeks ago. I personally came back 12 years ago. I'm a cradle Catholic. She told me that she felt great when she went to church and when she came out, but she also told me that she received the Eucharist. And I asked her if she had gone to communion or to confession beforehand since she's been away from the Catholic Church for so long. And she said no, that she hated confession and was afraid of it. And I told her that it was a mortal sin and also a sacrilege, and she didn't know what I was talking about.
Okay.
She said that she didn't know what that was. And I don't want to scare her away from coming to the church, but I also want to steer her in the right direction and want to know what to say to her.
Donna, this is admirable. You're doing the right thing. And you're correct. She does need to go to confession first. If somebody's been away from the church for years, obviously there's at least an immediate sin involved of not going to Mass on Sundays, okay, which is a mortal sin in normal circumstances, right? So it's with all probability that this person needs to go to confession regardless. It's not likely a person's going to be away from the church and not have fallen into some sin that wouldn't require sacramental confession. So, yes, she certainly would need to go to confession. Now, if she says she's afraid of it or wary about it or something, I would sit down with her and ask her, just why? What is it that seems to bother you? Now, you can share with her, of course, maybe if she's been away for quite some time, that she can go to confession either face-to-face with a priest or in the old-style box where she's hidden behind the screen and she couldn't be identified, whichever way she'd be more comfortable with. But one of the key things is that we have to acknowledge before all else that we're sinners and that we're unworthy completely of going to communion regardless. And yet Christ calls us to communion, but not without condition. And, you know, St. Paul writes about receiving communion unworthily, and that if we were to do that, we'd be guilty of the body and blood of Christ. We'd be bringing no grace into our souls. Just the contrary, we'd be bringing a new sin into our souls. So what we need to do is to understand that to go to communion, we need to be, first of all, in the state of grace to go to communion and then get further grace from it. And your friend needs to come to understand this. But it sounds, given what you were, the way you described her, that she's been very badly catechized at some point in the past. So you might need to begin with her in a very elementary way, explaining to her, you know, what sin is, why it makes a difference, why it needs to be confessed, and why we have the advantage in the Catholic Church of this wonderful sacrament of confession or penance or reconciliation, whichever term you want to use for it. I've always found it to be the most consoling of the sacraments, even more so than the Eucharist. Some people are able to receive the Eucharist and actually feel something, you know, when they do that. Most people don't, honestly. But for me, to the extent that I do feel something having received a sacrament, it's confession where I have that sense. And I've always found it especially consoling because in a way, it's the sacrament that is really about fallen human nature. It understands us the way we are with all of our limits and all of our foibles and all of our sins. And it's a releasing or freeing sacrament. It unloads this stuff from us. And yeah, you know, it's tough to tell another human being what you've done. It's embarrassing. It's humiliating. It's humbling. But if we love Christ, that's what we need to go through to approach him. And your friend needs to come to understand this. You'll find some materials at Catholic.com that can help you help her in that regard. And what I would recommend in particular for you, please call one of our staff apologists and talk through this kind of thing with her. We have men and women apologists on staff. Maybe one of the women in particular would be able to give you some suggestions about how to approach another woman, your friend, who's been away for so long and has this fear or wariness about the sacrament of confession. She might be able to give you some pointers that will assist you in helping your friend. But this is really key. She's not doing any good for herself. Simply go to Mass, go to communion if there's still serious sin on her soul. She needs to be shriven, as we used to say in the old days. She needs to be washed clean, okay? And she needs to be presentable, okay? You know, we don't enter the ballroom unless we're wearing the ballroom gowns and tuxedos, right? We don't come in T-shirts and jeans. There's a reason, you know, we have to be properly prepared. We have to be properly prepared to receive Christ in the Eucharist too. And that means having sanctifying grace in the soul. And we get that back by going to confession. And yes, it's the toughest thing of all the sacraments. All the other ones are easy because we don't really have to do much. Receive communion, you know, we put out our hands or stick out our tongue, and that's it. Very simple. But in confession, we have to confess, which is about the hardest thing a person can do because it's about one's own introspection. And yet that's what we have to do. So, again, I want to applaud you for consideration for your friend here. And I'd recommend that you do call our staff apologist and talk with one of them to get some pointers on how to deal with this particular situation. And then, you know, good luck, and we'll keep you and your friend in prayer.
Thank you, Donna. We go to John in Virginia, listening on the Catholic.com. John, you're on with Carl Keating.
Thank you for taking my call, Mr. Keating. I've got a context and a question, if you don't mind. The context is, I know there are groups who assert the primacy of the variants of the Douay Rheims based on its textual basis in the Vulgate, and it seems to me that that position is the most consistent historically with the theology of the Church. So my question is, and I may err in that assertion, but my question is, why does the Church allow these ecumenically produced critical texts to be used as a basis for recommended translations?
Well, actually, John, the reason is fairly simple. The critical texts, the modern texts, are actually based on better sets of ancient manuscripts than was the Douay Rheims. The Douay Rheims, which is the English translation of the New and Old Testament that those of us who are older were familiar with from our younger days, because that's what was used in church and elsewhere, has a lot of positive attributes to it. It also has a lot of incorrect translations. For example, when Monsignor Ronald Knox made his translation from the Vulgate into English in the 40s and 50s, he had to explain in doing that why there are a lot of mistakes in the Douay Rheims that he was correcting. Okay, and yet he wasn't even using the more modern texts that are available today. So there's a good reason to do that. You know, so there's one question about what text we translate from, and then a question as to whether the ending translation is better than it was. But the Douay Rheims had two deficiencies. One, the translation wasn't always that good, and it didn't have the best text to work from.
We have another hour of Open Forum coming up next. Tom Nash from Ave Maria Radio will be here, so stay on the line or get on the line if you haven't yet. Carl Keating, thank you very much for an hour.
Good to be with you.
Very, very nice. Thank you. All right. We'll be right back on Catholic Answers Live.